to say. Some of the most significant and consequential instructions for fatherhood is simply found in the Bible. But more specifically, I want to say that some of the most significant and consequential instructions for fatherhood, I believe, is found in a particular passage in the Bible, and that being Deuteronomy chapter 6. I'd like you to turn there with me, and we're basically going to remain right there, jump around just a little bit, but I want to use Deuteronomy 6 because of what this passage has to say. I'm going to use it in an expository message on this particular Father's Day. Deuteronomy 6, somewhat of a lengthy passage, but I think it definitely all applies to the fact and the understanding of fatherhood. Starting with verse 1, it says, "Now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which Yahweh your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear Yahweh your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as Yahweh, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh your God, Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one. And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. And you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. Then it shall come about, when Yahweh your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of good things, of all good things, which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns, which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant, and you shall eat and be satisfied. Then watch yourselves, lest you forget Yahweh, who brought you from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only Yahweh your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you. For Yahweh your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise the anger of Yahweh your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth." Now again, that's a lengthy passage. And it's one that I think oftentimes, or at least part of it, probably verses 4 through 9 at least, is oftentimes used in Father's Day's messages. At least it's one that I've used, I know, in some of the Father's Day messages I've preached in the past. But I want to take this whole passage, if we can get through it all this morning, and I want to use it as an expository sermon, because I think there's so much that is in this passage that cannot be addressed just when using the passage within another message. There's so much that we need to see and understand. And matter of fact, even as I prepared this message, it helped me to see more about fatherhood, specifically in this nation, the nation of America, that I've never really saw in the detail as I was preparing this message. So I want to take it a verse at a time, or at least a few verses at a time, and go through it. Starting with verse 1. Verse 1, I believe, is what could be called a commission unto Moses. Of course, we hear in the Bible, or when we think of a commission in the Bible, we usually think of the Great Commission as given by Yahshua the Christ before he ascended to heaven to his apostles. But I believe this is another Great Commission that was given, obviously, at a very earlier time in Israel's history. A commission that was given to Moses. Verse 1 says again, "Now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which Yahweh your God has commanded me to teach you, and that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it." And it continues. The whole commission carries on. But there in verse 1, the commission unto Moses begins. God therein commanded Moses to command the children of Israel to keep his laws in the land of Canaan in this case, where they were going in to possess it. And it's interesting. I just might point this out again, something that you should all know, but for those who may not. What is called commandments, statutes, and judgments in verse 1 of chapter 6 is simply the expanded form of what came before in chapter 5. Of course, we know that there were originally no subdivision between chapters and verses. It was just a carrying on. And when he said, "Now this is the commandments, statutes, and judgments," what was he talking about? What had he just addressed in the chapter previous, in chapter 5, or at least what we call chapter 5 today? It was the Ten Commandments. We know that the Ten Commandments are made up of statutes and judgments. You can't separate the two. And that is what he says. This is what I've commanded you, Moses, to command the sons of Israel as they are about to go in and possess this land, the land of Canaan. Now let me ask you a question in regards to that commission as we find it there at that period of time in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Was this commission just as applicable for the second land of promise as the children of Israel entered it? Now, somebody's bound to say, maybe not you, maybe not this audience, but somebody who might hear this tape is bound to say, what do you mean a second land of promise? I only know of one land of promise in the Bible. And you know how I would initially respond to that? Is why don't you know about the second land of promise? How come nobody's told you that the Bible also talks about a second land of promise? One that even sounds better than the first land of promise. Well, turn with me in case, for those who may not have ever heard, may not have ever had their preachers tell them that there was a second land of promise, turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 10. Familiar verse, at least for most of us. It says, "And I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again, nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly." Now, if somebody was to just hear that verse in and by itself, I really believe their natural inclination, for at least most people today in Christendom, their natural inclination would be to think that that is talking about this first land of promise, the land of Canaan. That was certainly a part of Israel's early history. But let me point out to you, let me share with you three reasons why this cannot be the land of Canaan, this land that is being promised in 2 Samuel 7 and verse 10. First of all, in this verse, it is described as a place where they would not be afflicted anymore. Or in other words, they were to be there dwelling in peace. It was something that was to happen. He says, "And I will also appoint a place where this will happen, where Israel can dwell in peace." Now let me ask you, why would God promise something in the future, another land of promise, when they were already at peace in the land of Canaan at that time? You see, the reason why most people would not understand or maybe would not recognize that this is not talking about the land of Canaan is because I haven't shared the context with you. And the context is at a time when Israel already is in the land of Canaan, is already at peace, and is dwelling safely from her enemies. And you could go to a passage in Judges to prove that, but you don't even have to do that. For the sake of time, I'm just going to go to the first verse of this very chapter and prove it to you. Look at verse 1. It says, "Now it came about when the king lived in his house, and Yahweh had given him rest on every side from all his enemies." Who is the king that's being described here, being spoken of? King David, is it not? Read the context, you'll find that it is. It's King David. After the conquest of the land of Canaan had already taken place, after he's on his throne and ruling over the United Kingdom of Israel, you can... And think back. Get David in your mind, the setting of David. Think about all that's happened between David and between Joshua. I mean, we're talking about a great lapse of time. We're talking about a previous king already having been on the throne, Saul. And now David, after this whole time of conquest has passed, David is on the throne at peace with his enemies, having conquered the land of Canaan. And yet in verse 7, the prophet Nathan comes to him and says, "David, God has told me to tell you that He will appoint a place for my people Israel. They're already dwelling in safety. How could it be that this is talking about the land of Canaan?" It does not fit the context. Secondly, the appointed place described is a place where Israel would move no more. Let me read it again. "I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, and they will live in their own land and not be disturbed again." The King James, and I believe it's more accurate, reads, "And they will be moved no more, nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly." Again, this cannot be the land of Canaan, because once Israel was in Canaan, that happened. they were moved again. Not because God designed it to be that way, but because of their disobedience, they were moved from out of that land. At least, if for no other reason, at least because of the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. So this can't, again, be the land. Canaan cannot be the land that's being promised here in verse 10. And then thirdly, David himself, and this cinches it, David himself interprets this as a future prophecy, not something that was happening in his day and time, but something that was to happen in the future. Verse 19, he says, "And yet this was insignificant in thine eyes, O Lord, Yahweh, for thou hast spoken also of the house of thy servant concerning the distant future. And this is the custom of man, O Lord Yahweh." David clearly saw that this prophecy made unto him by Nathan or through Nathan was a future prophecy, something to happen yet far in the future. And so for those three reasons alone, we can see that this is not a prophecy about the land of Canaan, not the first land of promise, but instead herein is described a prophecy that describes a second land of promise for Israel. Where? Where in the world could this second land of promise be? Well, you know, all you have to do to answer that question is correctly identify who Israel is today. And then it is very easily deduced where that new land of promise must be, especially with all the other descriptions that are given in the Bible for that new land of promise. For example, Isaiah talks about it being northwest of Palestine. Originally, that's their trek. They went northwesterly. And the ending up place for the majority of Israel, the regathering place of Israel, was northwest of Palestine in the United States of America and Canada. So it's very easy to determine it. Not only that, but many of our forefathers called this land where Israel has regathered just that. Now, if you understand that, again, that Israel today are the Anglo-Saxon, Germanic, Scandinavian, and kindred peoples, it's easy to find out where they ended up, where that primary second land of promise must be. But not only that, history and the quotes of our early forefathers who came to this land prove the very same thing. Let me share with you something you've probably heard before, but just to prove the point. In a sermon, grabbed the wrong thing here. In 1630, prior to the departure of the ship Umbrella for America, with Governor John Winthrop and his fellow Puritans aboard, a young Puritan minister by the name of John Cotton preached a farewell message. And I would say, can you possibly guess what verse it was or what passage he used as the text of that sermon? I think you probably already know. It was 2 Samuel 7:10. Now, I'm not going to at this point share from his message, but that was the text of his message. This promise that we just read that was given to David by Nathan of this new promised land. Let me read, not from his message now, but from what Samuel Eliot Morrison had to say in 1887 when he wrote concerning this event. He said, "Cotton's sermon was of a nature to inspire these new children of Israel with that belief that they were the Lord's chosen people, destined, if they kept the covenant with him, to people and fructify this new Canaan in the western wilderness," end quote. John Cotton used 2 Samuel 7:10 as the text of his message as John Winthrop and the Puritans were about to set sail for the new land. And then Eliot Morrison said in 200 years later, said regarding that message, those things, that they were headed for a new Canaan land in the western wilderness. Not only that, this is something probably you haven't heard, but in one of the Philadelphia public ledgers, and I don't have the date for this as of yet, one of the things I'm working on for my book, but in a Philadelphia public ledger, there was a poem that was called The Dragon's Flood, and I want you to listen carefully to what it has to say in regards to Christopher Columbus' voyage to America. Called The Dragon's Flood, and it uses Revelations 13:14 as its text, and it's which says, "And to a woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness." Here's how it goes. "America our heritage long lay, a wilderness until the fateful day, when over stormy seas the Mayflower bore the pilgrim fathers to New England's shore. There were no blasts of trumpets to proclaim their coming, all unheralded they came to brave the danger of the unknown West and found a home of hope for the oppressed. They were the pioneers of liberty, and they saw it not with clearer sight we see, but God's prevision they, and we are those who make the desert blossom as the rose. For he who holds the waters in his hand has brought us to a larger promised land. The westward course of empire has been run. The West returns towards the rising sun and brings her sheaves of bounty to restore old regions writhing in the throes of war. We bring the horn of plenty we have found unto old and worn and battle-ridden ground. We give our aid, our treasure, and our blood to help to stem the torrent of the flood. The dragon's mouth sent forth to overwhelm this children of a God-appointed realm who fled into the wilderness a while. We are preserved like Moses in the Nile. And he who knows his own, his chosen seed, and ever led his people and will lead. You know, very clearly, not only that, but even George Washington referred to America in one of his writings as the second, quote, the second land of promise. Our forefathers seem to understand what we have lost in the meantime, except for a remnant today, that there was the promise of the second land of promise and that America had to be it. And if America was the land of promise, let's just understand that that means that those who originally came to this country in the millions in the short 50-year period had to be the chosen descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, in relation to all that, I felt like I needed to establish that again, but now let me ask you again, in relation to that, was the commission given to Moses also applicable to our forefathers as they entered the lands of America, which they came over to possess as well? Was it just as applicable for them as it was when it was delivered to Moses when the Israelites were about to enter the first Canaan land? Well, if you were to listen to the teaching of many a modern-day preacher today, you'd say no. For they first don't know, for the most part, that we are Israel. And secondly, they teach that the laws of God have been abolished. But if you were again to listen to the statements of many of our forefathers, you'd say yes. But for they seem to understand that not only that we were Israel, at least for many of them, but also that the laws of God had never been abolished and that were still applicable today. Now let me read a portion from John Cotton's sermon, this time in regards to the law. Listen carefully, and they talk differently. At that time, they talk somewhat differently than we do today, so you got to listen carefully to what he's saying. But listen how closely it compares with the commission that Moses was given in Deuteronomy 6. Listen to what he says. He uses different words, but I think you'll catch it. He first asks the question, what course would you have us to take? And then he answers his own question with these words. He says, Have special care that you ever have the ordinances planted among you. And he's speaking about, when he uses the word ordinances, he is talking about the laws of God. Have special care that you ever have the ordinances planted amongst you, or else never look for security. As soon as God's ordinances cease, your security ceases likewise. But if God plant His ordinances among you, fear not, He will maintain them. Isaiah 4, 5 and 6, upon all their glory there shall be a defense, that is, upon all God's ordinances. For so was the ark called the glory of Israel. 1 Samuel 4 and verse 22. Secondly, have a care to be implanted into the ordinances, that the word may be engrafted into you and you into it. If you take rooting in the ordinances, grow up thereby, bring forth much fruit, continue and abide therein, then you are vineyard of red wine, and the Lord will keep you. Isaiah 27, 2 and 3. That no sons of violence shall destroy you. Look unto all the stories, whether divine or human, that you shall never find that God ever rooted out a people that had the ordinances planted amongst them, and themselves planted into the ordinances. Never did God suffer such plants to be plucked up. On their glory shall be a defense. End quote. That again from was John Cotton's sermon that was based again on that text of 2 Samuel 7 and verse 10. Also, let me read to you from the sixth grade McGuffey's Reader. Okay, it says, find the right spot here. It says they were, this is from the sixth grade McGuffey's Reader, and it says, quote, they were emphatically a peoples whose God was their Lord. Let me start a little bit, the sentence before that. It says, as deeply seated as was the principle of liberty and resistance to arbitrary power in the breast of the Puritans, it was not more so than their piety and sense of religious obligation. They were emphatically a people whose God was their Lord. Their form of government was as strictly theocratical, and then it goes on to say, insomuch that it would be difficult to say where there was any civil authority among them entirely distinct from ecclesiastical jurisdiction. Then it goes on, whenever a few of them settled a town, they immediately gathered themselves into a church, and their elders were magistrates, and their code of laws was the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is a term used for the first five books of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy. It went on, there, and a little bit later it says, God was their king, and they regarded him as truly and literally so, as if he had dwelt in a visible palace in the midst of their state. God was their king, and what was their law? Well, if God was their king, it had to be the king's laws. That's exactly what they said. The Pentateuch was their laws at that time. I could go on and I could read from several of the early documents and charters of each of the 13 states to prove that God's laws, His statutes and judgments, His commandments, were an integral part of this country in the very beginning. So if you were to listen to our forefathers, rather than our modern-day preachers, you'd say, yes, that commission was just as applicable and is just as applicable for the people who fructified America as it was for those who went into the land of Canaan. And not only that, all you have to simply do is rightly divide the word of truth, and you will also answer yes, that it was just as applicable for our forefathers in this country as it was for our forefathers as they entered the first land of promise, the land of Canaan. Now, I don't have time to prove that is what the scriptures teach, but anybody who on the tape ministry who may not have heard my message harmonizing the New Testament scriptures and the laws of God can order tape number T065, and I'll be glad to send that to them. Let's go on now. Back to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6, and let's now read verse 2. Verse 2, before we read it, describes what I call the three-generation principle. Listen to what it says. It says, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear Yahweh your God, to keep all His statutes and His commandments which I commanded you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. I hope you caught the three generations. He said that you and your sons and your grandsons, so that you, your sons, and your grandsons may do this. Do what? Keep these statutes and His commandments all the days of your life, so that your days may be prolonged. It's again what I call the three-generation principle. Each of us, I believe, God has given us the responsibility of three generations. Ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren. I believe you'll find another form of this three-generation principle in 2 Timothy chapter 2. I'll go ahead and start with verse 1. Paul writes to Timothy and he says, you therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in the Christ Yahshua. Verse 2, and the things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. He told Timothy, Timothy, you take what I've taught you and you teach it to others who will also be able to teach it to others as well. Actually, there's four generations there because it was the three-generation principle in continuation. It was from Paul to Timothy to faithful men, and faithful men to others who would also be obviously able to teach others, who would also take it down through the three-generation principle. There it's dealing specifically with spiritual generations, more so than possibly than it is physical generations, as we find in Deuteronomy chapter 6. What it is, what we find in Deuteronomy chapter 6, is what I also call a formula of success. And if carried out, think about this, the three-generation
principle. If it's carried out, if I personally and you personally are not only responsible for my generation, for myself, but also responsible for the next generation and the next generation as well, that I take it upon my shoulders as my responsibility to not only assure my own faithfulness, but the faithfulness in the next two generations. That is a formula for success. And if carried out, the dominion given to us can never be lost. Proverbs 22:6 also verifies this when it says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it." Now, I don't believe that's a lock solid commandment there, or statement by God. I believe it's a principle. There will be exceptions to the case because each individual has that ability within himself to make his own choice. But the principle, if followed through as it is designed to be followed through and as should be followed through, it generally will reap that benefit, or that result rather, that a child when trained up as he should be trained up will not depart from it when he is old. Problem is that we're not training. It's not so much that we have the exceptions to the rule, though there are some. The problem is we're not carrying out the rule. We're not teaching. We're not taking on the responsibility of our generation, the next generation, and the generation to come. I really believe that it's a, matter of fact, I don't believe this, I know this, that it is primarily the responsibility of the fathers. And that's why, again, I chose this text for this message. Ephesians 6:4 points it out very clearly when it says, "And fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord." It's the father's responsibility to teach, more so than the wives. It is their responsibility to make sure that the next generation and the following generation are brought up in the instruction of the Lord. Turn with me, also another verifying passage to this fact. Turn with me to Psalms, in the 78th chapter. You know, I again have to wonder, too, that if many of the exceptions, and again, I do believe that there are exceptions to Proverbs 22:6, but again, I have to wonder if many of the exceptions that would seem to be legitimate exceptions are not exceptions simply because the fathers didn't do the teaching and instead the mothers did. God obviously understood that there was something more solid about the father being the primary, being the one primarily responsible for teaching the young in the instruction of the Lord. He obviously understood that. So that it would have a greater effect upon a child's life than if it was just the mother doing it. And we know, we can testify that the generations, the previous generations at least, not so far back, maybe, I don't know how far back, but we know that for the most part in Christendom today, it has been laid upon the shoulders of the mothers and the shoulders of Sunday school teachers as they carted them off to Sunday school and stayed home to watch the Broncos or whoever play their games. You know, are the exceptions that we have, at least the majority of the exceptions, are they really legitimate exceptions to Proverbs 22? Primarily the responsibility of the fathers, as I believe is so well stated in Psalm 78, verses 5 through 7. Listen to what it says. It says, we will not conceal them from their children. Excuse me, that's verse 4. Verse 5. "For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell them to their children, that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments." What did it say? "For he established a testimony in Jacob, appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded to our fathers." What's that passage in reference to? Deuteronomy chapter 6. That's exactly what it is referring to. It doesn't mention fathers there, but it mentions fathers here in reference to that passage. King pages. The responsibility of fathers, at least primarily. Now, are the fathers of this generation, the generation that we're in right now, are they fulfilling their responsibilities? Have they been fulfilling their responsibilities for the last three generations? No, not at all. Or very, very seldom is it happening. And the result, what's the result of that? Of all of that? The result is that that the dominion, at least here in America, and then you can know that through the rest of the world, it's not even more so, that here in America, the dominion has been lost. Why? Because the fathers have shirked their duties as teaching and proclaiming the laws of God and the laws of Christianity under their offspring. You know, I have to envy, I often do, especially around Father's Day. I like to listen whenever I can to Dr. James Dobson. He doesn't have a lot right. I mean, there's a lot of things he doesn't have right, but there's a lot of things that he does have right, too. And when it comes to the family, that man has a lot to share, and I'm glad he's out there, especially for people in our circles, because we have a tendency maybe not to deal with that as much as we maybe could or should. And there's good that our people have people like him who have centered on that area of Christian living that we need. But you know, I have to envy him sometimes, and people like him who have had fathers who have left a legacy under them. You know, often at this time, just this last week he did this, he spoke of his father. He spoke of how his father had left him that spiritual legacy, how he was so much a part of his life, how his father fulfilled this responsibility. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that his grandfather was one who handed it on down. Wherein that three-generation principle was carried out. You know, I can't claim that, and I envy it because I can't. I didn't have a father who passed on those kind of things to me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I have a great father. He lived a life outside of Christ, but he still was a very good man, and a lot of ways very godly. He wasn't a man who beat his children. He wasn't a man who went out on his wife. He was faithful to his and still is faithful to his wife. He was a man who didn't ask us to do things that he himself went out and did at the same time. In other words, he wasn't a hypocrite. But at the same time, as good as my father was in many of those ways, he wasn't a man who handed down that legacy in Christ. But you know, in spite of that, I can look and I can be thankful, and we need to be thankful that God has made it possible for there to be cycle breakers. That things can change, and that we need to understand that this can be a generation which starts over, which can turn things around. We can start over. And I can raise my hand. I'm a cycle breaker. At least I hope to be. I know I was for my life, and I hope to be for those three little ones in the back seat back there, and for their grandchildren if they have them as well. That is my plan, to be a new, not only a cycle breaker, I was the cycle breaker, but to start a whole new cycle that goes for generations at a time, that carries on. You know, when I need to say this, I believe with all my heart that fathers are primarily responsible, and it's because fathers have been irresponsible that America's in the state that she is in today. But I also need to state, when I state that when fathers are irresponsible, that the mothers need to step in. And I think that is so well proven. If you turn to 2 Timothy chapter 1. Listen as I read this, verse 5, and listen again for the three-generation principle. Verse 5. Oops, I'm in the wrong Timothy here. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 5. Listen, it says, "For I am mindful of the sincere faith within you," speaking to Timothy, or writing to Timothy, "for I am mindful of the sincere faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am sure that it is in you as well." You might remember a previous Father's Day message that was entitled, "Where Have All the Fathers Gone?" I believe I used that one as my text. Why? Where was Timothy's father? And where was Timothy's grandfather, who should have been the ones who passed it on? They didn't, or they'd have been mentioned. But thankfully, the grandmother and the mother stepped in so that three-generation principle wouldn't be broken, that Timothy would have the chance to be the great evangelist he became. And so mothers do need to step in. You know, if it wasn't for mothers today, Christianity would maybe be nothing but a memory, because fathers have shirked their duty so bad, or have failed in this area so miserably. And, you know, let's face it, men. You know, why is that the fact? Why have men failed in this area? We just need to face it. It's simply because we as men tend to be much more self-seeking and selfish than do women, even to the detriment and the demise of our children. We have that tendency, and we might as well just face it and wear it. Face it so that we can change it, especially in this particular area. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6 again, going on to verse 3. Deuteronomy 6, verse 3, it says, O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as Yahweh, the God of our fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. What does verse 3 describe? It describes not the benefits of keeping the laws of God. And you heard me right. It describes not the benefits of keeping the laws of God. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 25 and 26. It says, When you became the father of children and children's children, three generations, and have remained long in the land, and act corruptly and make an idol in the form of anything, and do that which is evil in the sight of Yahweh your God, so as to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you shall surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it. It shall be utterly destroyed. The exact reverse of what I just read in verse 3. He says, if you do this, this is the benefits you'll receive. Deuteronomy chapter 4 says, you do this, and this is what will be taken away from you. The exact opposite. But what did it say? Verse 25, when you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land, and as three generations act this particular way, then this is what will occur. The same, the exact opposite is what is stated in Deuteronomy 6. It describes not the benefits of keeping the laws of God. It describes the benefits of the three-generation principle. He says, carry it out from generation to generation, and you will remain long on the land, and it won't be destroyed. You see, we've got to stop just thinking about one generation at a time. We've got to just stop thinking about the generation to come, the one that's found in our offspring. You know, and here lately, we've even done a terrible or poor job at that as well, of thinking about even the next generation. You know, we're now in the me and the now generation is how our generation is described. Or grab all the gusto while you can generation. You know, we hardly even think about the next generation. No, we only think about me as a people anymore. Our generation. Only our generation. What do you think of when I... Give me an answer, somebody in the audience, maybe two or three of you even if I need it. What do you think of when I say the word posterity? Excuse me? Okay, anybody else? Future? Okay, you're not coming up with the answer I thought you'd come up with. Excuse my wife. She came up with the answer I thought. And it's the one I thought of. When I thought of posterity... At least in the past, I thought of my children. And I think, I may be incorrect on this, but I would bet that that is what most people think of when you say the word posterity. They think of their children. That's the wrong answer. You guys came up with the right answer. If you look it up in Webster's Dictionary, you'll find that it means all future generations. One of you said generations, one of you said future. It means all future generations. We've got to just stop thinking about ourselves and even just stop thinking in light of just the next generation. God intends us to think, if nothing more, at least our children's children's generation. That is God's plan for us, and we have digressed so terribly from it. Proverbs 13:22. Listen to what it says. Here is the principle. It says, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. A good man leaves, not you don't plan to just leave an inheritance for your children. children's children. That's a good man. Pastor Earl Jones describes that as high-class thinking. And we don't have. We're a bunch of low-class thinkers anymore in this country. Especially when you see the bumper stickers in the back of the Winnebagoes that said, "I'm spending my children's inheritance." How digressed we've become from what God's plan for us as fathers is as found in the Scriptures. And not only, let's not take the principle that's found in Proverbs 13:22 and think that it applies to only in physical inheritance, but also to a spiritual legacy. Keep in mind, Matthew 6 and verse 33 says, "But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these other things, the physical inheritance, will be added unto you." We need to seek first His kingdom, not only for ourselves, but as an inheritance for our children's children. Patrick Henry wrote this at the end of his will. He said, quote, "If I have now disposed of all my property to my I have now disposed of all my property to my family, there is one thing more I wish I could give them, and that is the Christian religion. If they have that and I had not given them one shilling, they would be rich. And if they have not this and I had given them all the world, they would be poor." End quote. We've got to look at this three generations. And thankfully there are some people who are planning for the future of their future generations, at least their children, with a physical inheritance. But God's plan is to do much more than that. Firstly, most importantly, to also share with our children and our children's children a spiritual legacy as well. Deuteronomy 6, going on, verses 4 through 9. It gives what I believe is a three-ingredient recipe for not only possessing, but also maintaining dominion in the kingdom. Verse 4, it says, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one. And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in the house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead, and you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates." I hope you caught the three-ingredient recipe for possessing and maintaining the kingdom. And it's this simple: faith, love, and obedience. And somebody's bound to say, it can't be that simple. It just can't be that simple for us to possess and maintain the dominion of the kingdom. Let me tell you, it's that simple: faith, love, and obedience. But just leave out one generation or one ingredient and the dominion is lost. It's also that simple to lose the dominion. And I think we've seen it happen. Verse 4 describes faith. Verse 4 again, it says, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one." This is what he's saying. This is the God you are to believe in. And there's only one. He is Yahweh. It begins here. Hebrews 11:6, very, very clearly from the New Testament says, "And without faith, it is impossible to please Him, for he who draws near to God must believe that He is and that He's a rewarder of those who seek Him." Faith under the New Covenant, then, we know, must also lead us to salvation in Yahshua. Galatians 3:26 and 27 says, "For you are all sons of God through faith in the Christ Yahshua. For all of us who have been immersed into the Christ have been clothed with the Christ." That faith in God, that's where it's got to begin. Under the new covenant, the covenant we are under, it also must lead us to salvation in Christ, or it's not faith at all. And then 1 John 5, once we're there, 1 John 5, 4 through 5 comes into play, where it says, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that overcomes the world, our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world? But he who believes that Yahshua is the Son of God." That is our victory, at least it's one of the three ingredients for our victory over this world. And what is victory over this world? Possessing and maintaining the dominion. It's not getting raptured and getting to go to heaven. Verse 5 describes love. Verse 5 it says, "And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." You know, he couldn't emphasize the responsibility we have before God in loving Him in any greater terms. He said, with everything within you, you are to do it. And what is that kind of love describing? It's describing, it describes a love that seeks the receiver's will in everything throughout. It describes the kind of love which puts God first above everything else. If you love Him the way that is described in that foremost and greatest commandment there in Deuteronomy 6:5, it's a kind of love that automatically makes God first above everything else. Now, how does one, if that is what that kind of love does, it's the kind of love that seeks the receiver's will in everything, how does one determine the will of another? That's a legitimate question. If that kind of love seeks the receiver's will, we need to determine how does one determine the will of another. You know, I can remember, I don't know, seen books in Bible bookstores, and I can specifically remember a series of messages that was delivered by a preacher in a church I was involved with in Colorado a few years back. A series of messages, and I believe it was titled, How to Determine the Will of God. I remember a whole bunch of sermons that were preached to help us discern the will of God. And I'm sure everybody came out at the other end of those sermons almost as confused and ununderstanding of the will of God as they did on the front part of it. They were good messages, don't get me wrong, and everybody enjoyed them. But it was like by the time you were done with all these messages on trying to understand the will of God, it was like you can't do it. It can't be done. You know, it is real difficult for the average Judeo-Christian to understand the will of God. You know why? Well, it's because they, for the most part, have done away with God's will. Well, why would Christians ever do that? But that's exactly what they've done. For you see, those who are doing away with God's laws are doing away with God's will. You know, it is very difficult to understand, to determine the will of someone unless it's laid out in commandment or law form. But once you have it laid out in commandment and law form, the will of that other is very easily determined. But no wonder Judeo-Christianity is preaching these sermons. How do we determine the will of God? When they've thrown out the absolute, the laws of God. Matthew 7:21-23 proves, we're not going to have time to turn to that, so I'm going to just, you can do that on your own. But Matthew 7:21-23 proves the fact that God's laws and His will are one and the same. It's the passage that says that, I don't have time. You read it. Good for you to go back and do that anyway. Make sure I'm giving you the right scripture and telling you right. Question then, in understanding love for God, how is love for God determined then? It's determined by doing His will. 1 John 4:2-3, couldn't describe it better, where it says, For this is love for God, that we keep His commandments, that we keep His will. And His commandments, or His will, are not burdensome. Verses 6 through 9 of Deuteronomy 6 describes the third ingredient of the three, and that being obedience. Verse 6 gives what I believe is the prerequisite for the three-generation principle to work. It gives the prerequisite. You know, the commandments and the statutes that God has given us to keep cannot be kept or must not just be performed. Or they must not just be dispatched. Or they must not just be executed, or we become nothing more than just whitewashed tombs. If that's all that we're to do with them. That was Israel's problem, by the way, under the Mosaic Covenant. That's all she did. And no wonder it ended up, as a result, with the Pharisees as the head of their religion. Verse 6 says, And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. Whose heart? The hearts of the first generation, the fathers. And these words which I am commanding you today, these laws, shall be on your hearts. They must be written first. The prerequisite to the three-generation principle, the prerequisite is that the laws, the words of God, be written on the first generation's heart. And don't think that our children can't tell the difference.
They certainly can. Turn back to Deuteronomy 4 once again in verse 9. It says, "Only give heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and make them known to your sons and daughters." They'll know if you're keeping your soul diligently, if these things are written on your heart, not just done out of rote, not just done out of the letter of the law, but if they're a part of you, if they're a part of your heart, if you're keeping your heart and your soul diligently in order to keep them. Don't think our children can't tell the difference. The results will be determined on whether which of the two we're doing at the time. Somebody once said it this way. It says, you can't teach secondhand truth. You tell secondhand truth. You can only teach what you have experienced. End quote. That's what I believe is being described in that one verse, the prerequisite, what I call the prerequisite to the three-generation principle, is that we've got to experience the laws of God. We've got to make them a part of us. We need to get excited about them. I can remember a sermon also when I was in this same church teaching, starting to understand myself and also being responsible enough to teach the laws of God to the people, and how the pulpit minister, the senior minister of the church, got up in one sermon and preached how I'll give a silver dollar for several dollars, I forget what it was, but he said, I'll give a certain amount of silver to anyone who can say that they get excited about the laws of God. I should have stood up, but I didn't. But I sat there and I thought, man, I'm excited. He didn't need to pay me about being excited either. I was excited at the time about God's laws. They'd become a part of my heart. And that's how it needs to be for our sake of our children, for the next generations again. Listen, turn again back to Psalms 78. Which we already read once, but I want to add one verse to what we already read. Psalms 78, verses 5 through 8 this time. It says, "For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should teach them to their children, that the generation to come might know, even the children yet to be born, that they may arise and tell them to their children, that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments." Verse 8. It says, "and not be like their fathers." In other words, start the three-generation principle over because it didn't work from the beginning. Why? It says, "and not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart and whose spirit was not faithful to God." I guarantee you, if our generation, the beginning generation, if we start to turn this thing around again, if it's not within our hearts, it will fail for us just as it failed for them. It's got to be a part of us, not just something we do because we feel we have to in order to be right before God. Bill Gothard, I believe, was the one who made this statement. He said, quote, "We have weak churches because we have, excuse me, we have a weak nation because we have weak churches. We have weak churches because we have weak families, and we have weak families because we have weak fathers." End quote. You can see within that, even again, the three-generation principle, from fathers to family to churches to even the nation. We have a weak nation today, simply put, because we have weak fathers. Ezra 7, Ezra himself is such a great example in this area. In Ezra 7 it says, "The good hand of God was upon him." Listen to what it says. "For Ezra had set his heart to study or seek the law of Yahweh, to practice it and to teach his statutes and judgments in Israel." And I hope you caught the order of what's said there. It says that he first set his heart to study or seek his law, then to practice it, and then to teach it. We've got no business teaching it if we haven't first sought it, if we haven't first studied it and made it a part of our heart, and if we haven't also then put it into practice. And it needs to be in that particular order. Turn quickly to 2 Timothy. Second Timothy chapter 4, verses 15 and 16. Excuse me. That's not right. First Timothy 4, verses 15 and 16. Just listen to it as I read it to you. It says, "Take pains with these things. Be absorbed in them so that your progress may be evident to all. Pay close attention to yourself and to your teaching. Persevere in these things, For as you do this, you will ensure salvation both for yourselves and for those who hear you. Who was that admonition given to? It was given by Paul to Timothy, and it was given in a general sense for all those who would be under his leadership. But let's take it and apply it now to fathers. Fathers, take pains with these things. Be absorbed in them. Why? Do all of these things so that those who hear you, so that you'll ensure salvation for yourself and for those who also hear you. Who? Your children and your grandchildren. It needs to be from our heart. Let me share a little. We received this. It was a copy of a card in relation. I believe it was in relation to when Derek was born. And inside this card was written a poem. The poem entitled "God Bless This Baby" by Stephen E. Jones. Here, this is how it goes. It says, "God bless this baby, this gift from the Lord. Thank you for life, for blessings outpoured. Give him thy word with its light from above. Give him thy bountiful love. Teach him thy law with its wisdom and light. Give strength and purpose to do what is right. Give him a heart that will seek after thee. Grant him thy kingdom to see." You know, when I first got that, didn't really care too much about the card, but I really liked that poem. You like that poem? You know what? That poem is wrong. I just realized it this morning as I was finishing the message. That poem is all wrong. The prayer is all wrong. It's a good prayer, not one that we maybe necessarily shouldn't pray at times, but the prayer, the emphasis is wrong. That's not God's responsibility to do those things. It's the daddy's responsibility. And maybe this instead should be the prayer that should be said instead. "Dear God, my little boy of three, he said his nightly prayer to thee. Before his eyes were closed in sleep, he asked that thou his soul would keep. And I, still kneeling at his bed, my head upon his tousled head, do ask with deep humility that thou, dear Lord, remember me. Make me kind, Lord, a worthy dad, that I may lead this little lad in pathways ever fair and bright, that I may keep his steps aright. Oh God, his trust must never be destroyed or even marred by me. So for the simple things he prayed with childish voice so unafraid, I trembling ask the same from thee. Dear Lord, kind Lord, remember me." It's not God's responsibility to make our children what they should be. It's our responsibility to ensure by the way we live and what we teach that they become what he intends them or wants them to be. Verse 7 through 9, I don't have time to go back and read it, but therein is described what could be called in one word, saturation. Taking God's word and saturating our children with it. Putting it on the doorpost, everywhere that they go. As I mentioned in another message, there is an estimated 500,000 questions asked by a child between the ages that they can talk and between the ages of 15. Do you know what those are? As I've stated before, that's 500,000 opportunities to share something about the meaning of life with that young mind, and specifically in relation to the laws of God. I'm not going to make it. I'm running out of time here. Verses 10 through 15 describe the outcome of disobedience. You'll just have to read those for yourselves. But let me state this in closing this message out, and that is that the dominion can be ours. And that's simply by becoming obedient to the three-generation principle with the three ingredients of faith, love, and obedience. We have to stop looking at ourselves as in a 100-yard dash and instead in a 1,000-yard relay where the baton is passed on to not just our children, but on to our posterity. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.